This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. A government shutdown looms in Washington. The House approved a stopgap measure to fund the government through mid-February, but Senate Democrats appear to be dissatisfied and want concessions like deportation protection for some young immigrants. And the Supreme Court has temporarily blocked an order from federal judges to redraw North Carolina congressional maps. Plus, former White House strategist Steve Bannon has been subpoenaed by the Mueller investigation to appear before a grand jury. And now the House Intelligence Committee has also issued a subpoena. There's plenty to talk about with the political junkie Ken Bruton, who joins us now. Hello, Ken.
You know, Frank, the name of the show is The State of Things. Can I tell you what I think about the state of things?
I'm not sure.
It's unbelievable.
It's really, it's pretty incredible. All week, you know, we've been putting this stuff together and say, oh, did that happen this, oh, that happened this week. That happened this week.
You can't do this show in advance. You can't do it 2 days in advance. That's for sure.
No, and state requires, as talks about something stationary and static, and it's anything but. Let's start with the immediate news. Where are we now on the continuing resolution? House has passed it. Senate should be taking it up today, right?
That's correct. The deadline is midnight tonight. I don't see how it passes. I don't, first of all, Donald Trump, President Trump, tweeted today talking about how the Democrats don't believe in security and helping the military and things like that. That's kind of a weird way to begin negotiations or try to begin negotiations. Actually, if you talk about negotiations, we could just go back a few days ago when the president talked about the used the S-hole word when he's talking about immigration. So there is bad faith on both sides. And unlike the House, which majority rules, in other words, it didn't need any input from the minority, the Democratic minority, in the Senate, you need 60 votes to pass this continuing resolution. And, of course, if all the Republicans stay together, and we don't know if John McCain is voting or not, but let's just say there are 50 Republicans, that means you need 10 Democrats to vote for it. And that is very unlikely, given the fact that the Democrats are demanding certain things like protection for Dreamers, as you said. And we don't even know if there is a united Republican front, because there are other Republicans, like Lindsey Graham, like Mike Rounds of South Dakota, perhaps others, who have big problems with it.
Well, and as you said, there were negotiations that could have kept us from this precipice over immigration that went on earlier this week, and then the president's vulgar, racially charged outburst scotched those negotiations. So here we are. Let's talk a little bit about the politics of this, though. We had the Freedom Caucus and conservative Republicans, again, threatening to withhold their support in the House. They eventually supported this. Why did they go along with a bill that looked like something that they were going to, as I say, withhold support?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, a lot of times we've seen Republicans. We saw this with Marco Rubio with the tax bill, that a lot of Republicans will threaten to withhold their votes because they want certain things, they have certain demands, and they're not met. Mark Meadows of North Carolina, who's the chairman of the Freedom Caucus, said that we're going to withhold a lot of votes if we don't get X, Y, or Z. And the Republican leadership said, no, we're not doing any changes, and they backed down. But the point is, what the House passed yesterday, mostly on party line votes, is that they would extend the funding of the government for 1 month. This is the fourth time we've done this. There's no negotiations. There's no agreements. They just keep putting it down the road and down the road. And this time it's until February 16th. But they also said they would fund the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, for 6 years. And they're saying, well, I don't know why the Republicans, why the Democrats don't go along with that. But the Democrats say, look, there's no way, and especially they're getting heat from their progressive base. Democrats said, we're not going to go along with this bill and ignore the Dreamers who are subject to deportation. And it's about time we, the Democrats, stood up, because they did not. They backed down on a lot of things in 2017. And if you listen to the angry progressive base, they're just tired of backing down and making concessions without getting anything from the Republicans.
So that leads to the other political question. Who gets hurt if the government does shut down? Does this principled withdrawal of support put them in good standing with voters, that is to say the Democrats, in good standing with voters in 2018? Or are they responsible for the mayhem of another government shutdown?
See, the reason this question is so important is because ultimately This is about politics. It's not about, look, you know, I mean, the air traffic controllers will still be on the job. FEMA will still be on the job. The Postal Service will still be working as normal. Wait, that's not a good thing. But I mean,
it is a good thing. And by the way, let me just stop you right there, which is the president's erroneous Trump that somehow the military is going to shut down once again, showing not a total understanding of how our government works. He was wrong about that, misled the public. But go ahead.
But if you think of the last two shutdowns in 1995, 1996, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans caused a shutdown because because Clinton wouldn't sign on to a balanced budget amendment. And, of course, Clinton won the day. He painted Gingrich as an obstructionist, and Clinton went on to win re-election the next year pretty handily. Now, in 2013, the Republicans, led by Ted Cruz, shut down the government because they didn't like the Obama health care law that was being part of the government spending. So the government shut down for 16 days, and everybody thought that the Republicans would pay the price for that shutdown in 2013. But the following year, the GOP picked up a lot of seats in the House and the Senate. So this is about politics, and the question is not only who will blink first, but who will pay the – forget about all these people, these hundreds of thousands of people who will be furloughed and out of work. The real question – I mean, I'm saying this with irony here. The real question is who pays the political price. Democrats are convinced that Trump, having been embarrassed for the S-hole word and things like that, will be forced to negotiate. Republicans say, oh, no, what are you saying? You're going to shut down the government because of these people, these dreamers who are here illegally? So this really is all about politics.
So let's see, again, if we're reading tea leaves and talking about 2000 the elections later this year, let's go to Wisconsin now. A Democrat won a state Senate seat that had been previously held by Republicans in 17 years in a state carried by Donald Trump. Is this a harbinger or a one-off? What do we make of this?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you know, as with everything that in my life, what I'm going to have for breakfast, what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, everything goes back to Richard Nixon and Watergate. And welcome to my world. But back in 1974, there were these special congressional elections early in 74 in historically Republican districts that went to the Democrats. John Murtha in Pennsylvania is one example. And people said, I wonder what this means. Is this a harbinger for the general election? As it turned out, it was. A lot of people are pointing to the Democratic big wins in Virginia last year, the shocking victory of Doug Jones in Alabama, and now this special election in Wisconsin this week, and also we're coming up in March is a special election in Pennsylvania for a district that has long been held by the Republicans. Again, Republicans say they're not nervous, but one, the Democrats are united and unified and excited and enthusiastic. And again, if Republicans start losing elections like that, it could tell a lot about what's going to happen in November, but we're certainly not going to make those predictions here in January.
Public opinion has a lot to do with how elections turn out. Gerrymandering has an awful lot to do with it. You mentioned Mark Meadows. He represents a very progressive part of the state, half of the city of Asheville.
Right.
The reason he's there is because of gerrymandered districts that a federal district court found illegal, must be withdrawn, politically illegal, which is hard to do in this country. The U.S. Supreme Court has stayed that decision, not weighing in on the validity of the justice's ruling that the state legislature has drawn illegal maps, but rather you may not put them into effect now. What does all this mean for the state of North Carolina?
Well, it means a lot because obviously the original three court, the lower court panel said they had to redraw the lines by January 24th. The Republicans said that didn't give enough time. They went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed to stay the lower court decision until the Republicans could appeal to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court will be looking at key redistricting cases this year in Wisconsin, in state legislative elections, in Maryland, in Texas, and elsewhere. And so it's good news for the Republicans because it's very unlikely they will change these lines by the November elections. But you know, I mean, look, personally, I'm not a fan. I don't like what they do to gerrymandering. I think it does subvert democracy. But to call it, as the Democrats have called it, unconstitutional, well, that's what redistricting is. That's what gerrymandering is. I think it's abhorrent, and I think it's sometimes a disgrace. But it's not unconstitutional until the courts rule. And so right now, a lot depends on what the Supreme Court is going to decide in these other cases that it's going to hear this year.
But that's an important point, because it's not unconstitutional yet, because the Supreme Court has yet to weigh in, because they couldn't and have said we're not quite sure what responsibility the judiciary has to weigh in on what is clearly a legislative prerogative.
Right. They've hesitated for a long time to rule on this, exactly.
But the way in which things have been withdrawn and the misrepresentations to the level and with the math that has been given, the kind of misrepresentations that we're seeing that the courts have even found, has forced the courts to weigh in. So we're going to see some action on this, because the Supreme Court is looking at a case in Wisconsin and in Maryland that could have important implications.
Absolutely. But I'll tell you one thing, that even you could draw the safest Republican seats you want, but if the president still remains under 40%, and the last poll I saw, it was NBC New York Times, had him at 39% approval, the lowest after 1 year of any president in recent history, or at least in polling history. If Trump's numbers are low, if Robert Mueller finds more things or anything that will further doubt Trump's legitimacy, or at least his competence, then, you know, you could have all the safe districts in the world. A wave could wipe that out. But again, we have a long way to go before that happens.
Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned Robert Mueller, the Russia investigation. Steve Bannon subpoenaed to testify both before the House panel and before a grand jury under Robert Mueller's control. We're going to talk about that with you, Ken Rudin, when we continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with the political junkie Ken Rudin in Washington. Let's talk about the Russia investigation. Former White House chief advisor Steve Bannon subpoenaed to speak before the House Intelligence Committee. Let's talk about this, because a lot of people, as well as Robert Mueller's investigation, talk about the significance of a subpoena in this case.
Well, there are actually two separate subpoenas. Bannon was subpoenaed both by the House Intelligence Committee and Robert Mueller. The reason he was subpoenaed by the House Intelligence Committee is because he testified before the committee on Tuesday, and basically he said nothing. He wouldn't answer any question, and basically he was saying, well, you know, the White House may invoke executive privilege. It's interesting, given what Steve Bannon said about Donald Trump in the Fire and Fury book, you know, that Donald Trump Jr. was involved in treasonous activities and blah, 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 and given the fact that Trump said Bannon has lost his mind, you would think that maybe if he's spurned, that Steve Bannon would like to spill some beans. One, we don't know what Bannon knows. I mean, we don't know what he knows about the Comey firing or any meeting with Russians, but he certainly was close enough with the president that he would offer some information. But again, because his attorney, Bannon's attorney, was still telling the White House counsel, here's what I'm being asked during the House Intelligence Committee, you know that his relationship with the White House has not gone completely sour. Now, he's also being subpoenaed by Robert Mueller to testify. I don't know if he's going to testify before a grand jury, but clearly the investigators, the Mueller investigators, want to talk to Bannon, want to know what he knows. Certainly Bannon was around during the WikiLeaks and the stolen emails from Hillary Clinton and Podesta. He has information to all of that, which could be part of the Russian collusion investigation. If I were the White House, I'd be nervous. But again, if they can invoke executive privilege and Bannon doesn't say anything, then we're back at square zero.
Well, you're back at square zero, but you can't stay there for long. I mean, the point is that most legal analysts that I've heard so far have said that this interpretation of executive privilege is novel at the very least, which is to say it'll be challenged in court, which is to say the investigation will take a lot longer than we might have expected, because we have to wait for all these court decisions on whether or not he can be compelled to testify and executive privilege applies. Interesting only because the president says, hey, let's get this thing over with. And yet this is something, executive privilege, that's apparently going to stretch this thing out perhaps until the elections in November.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, of course, they want to get it over with quickly, and it's all fake news, and it's a witch hunt, and it's all fake. But you know that the White House is nervous about that. And one of the reasons you know they're nervous about it is that they've been trotting out Republicans, mostly in the House, but in the House and Senate, to basically discredit anybody who has any information about this. And rather than go after the people who may know something about Russian meddling and Russian interference, they're basically going after the people who are reporting on that. And if that's not a sign of nervousness in the White House, then, Frank, I don't know what is.
I want to talk about a controversial nomination by Donald Trump of Thomas Farr. This is very important to us here in North Carolina. Former lawyer for Jesse Helms. This appointment would be to a federal district court judgeship in North Carolina. Senate Judiciary Committee has approved the pick. What are the chances? There's been a lot of controversy and concern about his being responsible for some of the more racist campaigns that Jesse Helms was involved in, and some of the more nefarious tactics that he used. He could sit on the federal bench. What are the chances that he may be appointed?
Well, you mean confirmed, of
confirmed,
course, because
yeah.
because he got the appointment. Right. I mean, it's just remarkable some of the people that this administration has appointed to lifetime federal appeals court positions. The Senate committee, the vote was 11-10, which shows you that there's a lot of concern about his qualifications. Look, a lot of Republicans have worked for Jesse Helms. That doesn't make them all racist or part of a racist conspiracy. But the things that he's said and written in the past about race and race-related are just abhorrent. And I think that if there is any Republican backbone, if there is any backbone to this Republican Senate, this is exactly the kind of guy they should vote down. I mean, I'm not saying this as a D or an R. It's just that this guy is not only unqualified, but the things he has said and written just crossed the line.
He designed tactics in that campaign that courts have ruled illegal, and then figured out ways around that for the second time around. So, I mean, we're talking about very specific efforts to suppress the black vote that the courts have weighed in on. It's not as though this is a political opinion that you're expressing here. Ken Rudin, always a pleasure. Take care of that cold, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, all right?
Frank, what part of this was a pleasure? This is terrible.
This is terrible, but it's what we do for a living, and it's why we put our shoes on, Ken. You do a good job. Ken Rudin is the political junkie.